Okay, we're underway with that. And I wanted to say that we typically have these webinars every single week at the same time. And today is no exception from the last few weeks. We've been covering presenters that are part of the Freedom Law School's 2010 Take Back America Health and Freedom Conference, being held in Southern California, March 12th through 15th, actually at the Ontario Hilton Hotel. And for information on that particular conference, go to freedomlawconference.com. And an interesting thing about the particular conference, it not only has quite a lineup of speakers, attendees and vendors, but it also has it also is a conference that has no charge to attend. You're actually, you heard that right, you're actually able to go online and sign up for it and pay nothing to attend. Donations are very much encouraged, but no one needs to be turned away because of money issues, because of the particular economy that we're in now, the conditions that things are under. It's too serious to not get the information out, and we want that to happen. So that, I think that was Payman's thinking and doing it in this fashion. We're very fortunate today to have with us Tim O'Shea. And Dr. Tim O'Shea, he is going to address Goodbye Swine Flu, Another False Pandemic Fades Away. And there's some questions that we want to move through. But I thought I'd just start with asking Dr. O'Shea, if you would, Dr. O'Shea, maybe tell us just a little bit about yourself and how you came. And then we can just launch right into the questions, if that's okay.
You cut out there a little bit, Earl. Could you repeat that, please?
Okay. I was just asking if maybe as a beginning point, that you could tell us a little bit about yourself, because I don't have a bio for you.
Sure.
I don't think I know a lot about you, nor with anyone listening. So maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be involved in the way that you are today.
Okay. Well, I'm a chiropractor and I'm a clinical nutritionist from California. I've been in practice for 23 years. And about 10 years ago, I began researching vaccines, and I put together a seminar, a full-day seminar on vaccines. Actually, it's a seminar on the problems with vaccines. And that seminar I've been giving all over the world in various locations. And it's actually a continuing education seminar for a lot of health professionals. The textbook that I have to this seminar is called The Sanctity of Human Blood, Vaccination is Not Immunization. And that textbook is currently in its 13th edition. And the purpose of that seminar and the textbook is really that I just want to give really young parents and people who have small children in their lives enough information to be able to make what I call an informed decision about vaccines, because it seems like to me like the information that most people have about vaccines is very one-dimensional. It's coming from either from mainstream media sources or else it's coming from their clinics. And all these sources, what they have in common is that they are controlled by this epistemological approach that we are. It is all information coming from people who are selling the vaccines. So what I've discovered by my research is that my sources are mainstream medicine, mainstream science, mainstream law, and especially from the scientists who are formulating the vaccines themselves, from the manufacturers. That's my primary sources of information about what are these vaccines really made of and what effects, physical effects, can they really have on the formative immune systems of our young children. So I've been doing this for 10 years now, and my full-day seminar is really very complete. There's no fluff. It's jam-packed with this type of information. The difference between my work and a lot of sort of anti-vaccine sort of websites that you see that's out there is that everything I say is completely referenced. None of this is an impassioned essay or anything like that. All my this short textbook that I have of 200 pages has over 300 references in it, and they are all mainstream scientific and mainstream medical references. So that's the source of my information.
Well, what you're saying is very important, because you're approaching it from a very respectable, non-wild-eyed, speculative manner. It's nothing like that. And that will be respected and accepted quite well in many quarters, whereas this other approach sometimes just turns people off totally. I know we're talking about a vast sum of money that's involved with the drug companies, the medical cartel, the whole apparatus that's going on there, and there's a lot to it. And I can also appreciate the fact that you have a lot of information of which we can only skim the surface of today, but at least people can get an idea of what's available to them. I wanted to ask you, when was the original swine flu vaccine program, and what happened then?
Okay, as many adults can remember, back in 1976, there was an incident. There was a whole series of events. The first swine flu program took place at that time. I'm going to summarize this, but people can get a more complete story about what I'm talking about here by going on my website, which is thedoctorwithin.com, and going into the chapter section and reading and following along with the chapter called Goodbye Swine Flu. So back in 1976, what happened was there at a training exercise at Fort Dix, a soldier who had just come from a 13-mile run, the story goes, collapsed and died. And on autopsy, supposedly they found this unusual virus in him, and somebody said that it was a pig virus. That was never corroborated, and at that time, the National Institutes of Health were poised to launch. They were prepared to launch some global pandemic vaccine program based on anything, and the story goes that they used this incident as a trigger to launch their vaccine program. They called it swine flu, even though it had never been proven to have occurred in pigs prior to this time, and even though the vaccine was prepared in a very short time, just a few weeks, a mass produce for the entire for the entire country, and the vaccine companies were under a very strict deadline to get the vaccine out quickly, because they were marketing this threat as something that was threatening the entire country, and it got very political, and the vaccine was put out onto the market much too soon, before it had even been validated as an actual disease and before the vaccine had been tested as safe. And most of us can remember, if you've done the research, you remember what happened at that time in 1977, a couple months later, that, they set out to vaccinate the entire U.S. population. And after 10 weeks, they halted the vaccine after 50 million people had been vaccinated, because so many people were dying or were becoming paralyzed from the vaccine. So they stopped vaccinating after 50 million Americans had got the vaccine. Congress eventually ended up paying out $400 million in damages, and it was, up to that date, the worst vaccine disaster in American history.
Wow. Well, I'm wondering, was the swine flu ever demonstrated to be an actual distinct disease?
No, and that was the strangest thing. Before that time, no one had ever gotten swine flu before. It was never proven that that soldier had gotten anything called swine flu. It was never proven that that virus that they isolated in his body was the cause of his death. And finally, there was never a subsequent case of swine flu following that incident, you know, up until April of 2009.
Very interesting. Well, why was it called swine flu?
It was mischaracterized. It was like they had to put a name on it. That's a technique that we're going to see all through. In order to market an epidemic, the illusion has to be fostered that there is some novel virus, some brand new pathogen out there that is very virulent and threatens threatens our population. That is the way these things are marketed.
Well, it sounds like that there's a bunch of fear marketing going on to make people be so in fear that they take whatever action is recommended, which is basically lining the pockets of the drug cartel. So very interesting. Why did the NIH jump on the vaccine bandwagon so darn fast?
Because, like I said, you mean back in 1976?
Yes.
Yeah, because they were poised to the vaccine sales were really lagging at the time, and they really needed a shot in the arm to bolster up their sagging fortunes. That's the real reason behind it.
Mm. It just seems so callous that they would do this, but people will do so much for money. We can sure see that. Business as usual, I guess, at all costs. There's one thing I wanted to ask, that how soon was the vaccine created?
Just within a few weeks, maybe 2 months or something like that. A very few short weeks, and this is the same exact situation we see today with today's swine flu. It takes at least a year for any vaccine to be developed, to be tested as supposedly safe and effective, and to become licensed. A year is that's usually a minimum amount of time for a vaccine to be tested in order to be placed on the schedule, but this is the precise thing we're seeing today with the today's swine flu, which only began in April of this year. Well, what we learned is that there were five vaccine companies who got the contracts to produce the new H1N1 vaccine today. What I discovered was those five companies. They all began their clinical trials of the new H1N1 vaccine in August of this year, none of which trials was scheduled to be completed until April of 2010. And so even that is ridiculous. That's only a six-month period. That's like half the usual time to develop a vaccine. But it was much worse than 6 months. What happened was, the CDC wanted to get the new H1N1 swine flu vaccine out really fast by October, remember? And so the FDA was approving these brand new vaccines that had just started being tested in August, right? In August, they approved them after five weeks, and that is the H1N1 swine flu vaccine that people have been getting up till now.
Well, you know, it really just seems absolutely criminal for them to put something out like that without any history of testing it, perfecting it, you know, figuring out how it will affect things or what, you know, if it's up to standards, if it's ready to really be certainly to be rolled out in mass quantities to just have people take it in the way that they are. It's really unthinkable, but if people really understood the things you're saying now, and what is really going on, I think they'd practically be up in arms about it. They'd be very horrified. It's almost like something Frankenstein that's being done to people. Well, I'm wondering, why are they calling the new disease in Mexico swine flu? What was the reasoning with that?
That astounded me. I don't know why they did that. I really don't know why they did that, especially with the track record of that name being the worst vaccine disaster in U.S. history. Why they would use that term again really baffled me, especially since they even admitted that. Remember when Obama, after the first month or two, Obama came out and made them stop using the term swine flu, supposedly, and that's when the term H1N1 began to be substituted. The reason he did that was because he was getting all this these complaints from the bacon and pork industry, right? Like their sales went through the floor; they were selling nothing, and so they wanted to take away that sort of association with pigs then. Which was easy to do because they admitted at that time that the virus had never been isolated in pigs. So why they used this term in the first place was completely makes no sense.
Mm. Well, I'm wondering how the cases were diagnosed. In other words, what kind of screening tests to make sure all these people really have the same disease?
Yeah, well, that's really the starting point for my article on my website, thedoctorwithin.com, the chapter called Goodbye Swine Flu. That's my whole point, that at the very beginning of this current swine flu program in April of 2009, so the story went that all of a sudden hundreds of people supposedly in Mexico were in some remote areas in northern Mexico, right? They were getting this supposedly new disease, and I knew something was up. Within the first 4 days, they already started using that term pandemic, and that's completely ridiculous. When only a few people had died at that time, and I realized right away, well, how in the world could they be characterizing this disease as being the same among all these people who they were supposedly counting as having it, you know, because they hadn't come up with a pathogen, a specific pathogen that they were sure was causing this same disease among all these people, right? There was no screening test. And so really, to answer your question, how are they diagnosing the early cases? The answer is by symptoms only. And the symptoms were no different from regular flu because, you know, thousands of people die every year in the United States as well as in Mexico and in every country, thousands of people die every year of flu. And so this is the obvious thing that became apparent from the very beginning that it was an artificial recategorization of regular flu cases for the purpose of marketing a vaccine. That's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, really, really sad when people understand what we're seeing. Well, how many kinds of influenza viruses are there?
Hundreds and hundreds, thousands, really. There's three main types: influenza A, influenza B, influenza C, and then. Influenza A has, you know, hundreds of types, and then a subcategory of influenza A is the H1N1, which, you know, there are at least 700 types of that. But that, again, that's my point. The point is, first of all, no one strain of H1N1 has ever been proven to be the cause of any disease, let alone this particular, quote, epidemic. So, and the second thing is, Since there was no screening test all along, no valid screening test, they weren't culturing all these people to make sure that they all really had the same thing. That's the most incongruous feature of the whole program, in my opinion. And no media has ever been allowed to comment on this very obvious fact, this very obvious inconsistency.
Well, it seems to me that that implies that there's almost a, I don't know, what do you want to call it, incestuous, or anyway, the media and the drug companies and certain officials within the agencies of government are seem to be in lockstep to promote a certain agenda in a certain way and not veer from that course or that focus or that intention that they're set about doing. And that's kind of alarming in a way, because it's a lot of power and money amassed, you know, against our best interest. Kind of concerning. What in the heck is H1N1?
Well, it's one of the influenza A varieties. It's one strain. It's one strain of the hundreds and hundreds of strains of influenza A. Just something that they chose to assign it to this particular marketing program, really.
Okay. Just another marketing name. Why did Obama want to stop calling the new disease the swine flu?
Well, I already answered that. I already
oh, that's right.
That because of pressure from the pig farmers, from the bacon industry.
Yeah, that was it. and then I'm trying to remember, did you mention how many pigs have died from swine flu?
Yeah, none.
Not a single one. Okay, well, I just want to be sure I heard that right, because that's just so strange when in light of everything. It really is. Is there really any scientific evidence whatsoever to prove that these new cases of swine flu are anything different at all from just regular flu in any way, shape, or form?
No, I really can't see it, and that's my phrase. And it's being corroborated. My phrase is the 2009 swine flu program is really nothing more than the artificial recategorization of a number of cases of regular flu that were named this particular thing in order for the marketing and promotion of the new vaccines. This is being corroborated. It was suspected, and there were a few disjointed sources who were kind of getting this idea, but I have like three articles on this exact same, on the development of this whole idea on my website, and I was predicting it from the very beginning. All summer long I was saying the same thing, and what's sort of gratifying is now there is an investigation going on in Europe among a group of medical doctors. They're called the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, and they are now coming out. They just started this month and last month, and they're coming out and they're corroborating everything I have been saying all summer and all fall up until the present time. That's exactly what they are saying, that it was a false pandemic, that it wasn't a novel disease that suddenly, you know, descended from the heavens upon humanity or anything like this, but these were just regular flu cases, and the program was set up in order to market these very dangerous, untested new vaccines. There is a way that your listeners can find out about this particular investigation. You can Google this phrase. Just Google the phrase "false pandemic," and all these articles will come up on the European investigation. The medical doctor who's in charge of all of this investigation, that whole organization, his name is Wolfgang Wodard. And his name will come up over and over again. But once you see his name, then just follow up on that, and then you'll see he has so much. His last name is spelled Wodarg, Wolfgang Wodarg, MD. He's from Germany, and there are two organizations that are now investigating the collusion between the World Health Organization, who just rang the panic bell too fast, and the financial connections between the specifics of the financial connections between the World Health Organization and the vaccine manufacturers, the five global vaccine manufacturers who received the five contracts for producing these millions and millions of doses of H1N1 vaccine worldwide. So what originally sounded like, you know, everybody's calling me a conspiracy theorist all summer and everything, now everything that I have been writing about, it's all being corroborated.
You know, it's interesting that it happens so much in all kinds of endeavors. I mean, obviously there's conspiracy wackos out there, and there's things that are just totally out there. But so many times you'll find that today's conspiracy theorist is tomorrow's prophet almost. It's like, you know, you saw it, you called it exactly like it was, and it's interesting to see people vindicated down the line a little bit, whereas they were a target before that for ridicule or whatnot. To kind of review this whole thing, I think what we're seeing here is a huge marketing pattern. Is that not correct? How would you sum it up again about just what kind of marketing pattern we're actually seeing here?
Yeah, and that's really my conclusion. My conclusion in my whole article, Goodbye Swine Flu, at thedoctorwithin.com, is that's, you know, swine flu will be winding down now. What we're seeing now is a few last-ditch attempts to salvage the vaccines, which many states and most countries in Europe are now returning the supplies of vaccines. They're returning them to the manufacturers because people are not buying this epidemic. Even the people don't accept the incredible marketing plan that has taken place in the last 6 months. So we're going to see the whole swine flu program kind of wind down and disappear. But my point is, what we have seen here with swine flu in the last 8 years, this is the fifth time the same thing happened over and over again. It happened. It happened with smallpox, the smallpox vaccine program, then with anthrax, then with SARS, then with avian flu, now with swine flu. And the pattern goes like this. First, they invent a disease. They name a disease and claim that a new disease threat exists. And then they dream up some kind of pathogen that they say is causing this disease, even though no proof is ever offered for that. It's all media. It's all marketing. And then they maximize the threat to humanity. They'll say, okay, one-third of the population is in danger of dying or whatever, like they said for avian flu. And then the next thing it says, but wait, there is hope of salvation. What is it? Vaccines and drugs, you know. And then billions are spent on the vaccines and drugs. And then as soon as the money is spent, then we watch the threat just evaporate into thin air like it never existed, and then you don't hear about it again. And see, now I call this the boutique epidemic, or the made-to-order epidemic. Now the pattern is firmly established. Now that if they follow the steps, they can make it happen anytime they want, and that's what we can expect from now on. It just happened five times in the last 8 years, and it will happen again.
Mm. Yeah, we've certainly seen it over and over again before. I mean, of course, recently, just looking back on 2009 with all that hysteria with swine flu vaccine, I'm wondering, you know, as far as I don't know if you concur with this or not, but just in a nutshell, the way I see the media playing in this is that they become a marketing tool for the major corporations. And if you're watching any kind of TV and you see the number of drug ads that are on there, it's astounding. You think of the contract that they must have with the media.
Of course.
If they got calls from all the drug companies pulling their contracts, and can you imagine the financial impact? Can you imagine the arrangements they must have made that the areas that they don't report on?
yeah.
you know, that are off limits. And they want those dollars and they want the cozy relationship so everything stays intact. Some people put a lot more on it, but in some ways it's just business as usual. They're just doing
yes.
business and protecting their interest. And it's kind of nefarious, but and we don't like it, but that's what they're doing. At least to the way I see it. Is that kind of
yeah.
what you're saying anyway?
Yeah, you're right on the money. Who is the number one constituent of organized media? It's the pharmaceutical industry directly or indirectly. How long can you watch TV without seeing a drug ad? 5 minutes? 10 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
And the control of media is another thing. Who would be allowed to what media, either printed media, internet media, or TV media would be allowed to have somebody talking or making a case something like what we're talking about here? It simply wouldn't be allowed. This group of medical doctors that I was telling you about, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, I mean, these guys are you know, they're political, and they're very some of the highest ranking medical doctors in Europe, and yet this entire story has been completely blackballed from U.S. media. You won't read anything about their investigation in any of U.S. media. So the only way you can do it is when you Google false pandemic, or when you Google Wolfgang Wodarg, you will all the sources are European. It's locked into Europe, and it's not allowed to touch, you know, the American conventional wisdom or what everybody is exposed to in media here. Of course, it's very controlled.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with, I discovered it's the same with Wikipedia. That's why I never use Wikipedia as a source. They're not a legitimate source of research. Did you know that there are 140 medical doctors employed by Wikipedia to make sure that anything that is remotely health-related, vaccines-related, drug-related, that there is never any kind of anything but the mainstream allopathic pharmaceuticals are going to save us kind of a mentality that is allowed to be edited into the articles and literature and searches of Wikipedia. No kind of holistic or alternative medicine type of opinions are allowed to be printed there unless they're approved by these 140 medical doctors, who will always add their conclusions and their evaluations at the end of every little article. So Wikipedia is the most reactionary, and they pretend like they're very open and it can be edited by anybody, but it's really one of the most controlled forms of media that there are.
Wow, that's interesting. A lot of people would find that a real revelation. I think, you know, that's one example of many areas where we see things being used as propaganda devices and facts skewed and disinformation inserted in things and stuff just pretty much neutralized, or at least where people get so confused they don't know what the truth is. They hear a little of this and a little of that, and they completely conflict, and they don't know where to turn. But the preponderance of information is disinformation that put out through the major sources, unfortunately. When the mercury limits for the swine flu vaccine were dropped for the first time in history, that was kind of a shock. I mean, wasn't that was amazing, wasn't it?
Yeah. Now, that happened in September. I was in Seattle at that time, and This was right when by September of this past September, you know, that the swine flu vaccines were only 1 month into production, right? They just started in August, and what I found out from a pronouncement by the one of the secretaries of health, the secretary of health in the state of Washington, came out with that pronouncement about, you know, since there's such a shortage of swine flu vaccine, they are going to the FDA is going to drop the the limits, drop the limits of thimerosal that can be added to the vaccine. That's the mercury in the vaccine. So they're telling us that in the new swine flu vaccine, there are going to be unlimited levels of mercury. They can put as much mercury as they want into the new swine flu because their excuse was because we're in such a hurry to get the vaccine out because it's such, this pandemic is such an emergency. It's a level 6 pandemic and all that stuff. And first, I was totally shocked and amazed to read that in mainstream media. But what it indicated to me was, it was an indication to me that maybe this is, maybe the vaccine that they're giving out to people, a swine flu vaccine, is not a newly invented, a newly created vaccine at all. Because if they're just making new vaccine starting in August, well, they can put anything they want into it. Why did they have to put unlimited levels of mercury in it? So that made me think that what they're probably doing here is this was a way to market these old stored doses of avian flu vaccine, which they never sold because avian flu disappeared, or maybe even the stockpiled doses of the 1976 swine flu vaccine, which are still in storage on shelves somewhere, because they never throw out old vaccines. They always stockpile them. So that, again, that was another major red flag when they announced unlimited levels of mercury for the new swine flu vaccine.
Wow. Well, how many doses of flu shots are being recommended for children by the CDC and the at this time for this winter season?
Okay. The answer is 4. 2 shots of regular flu vaccine and 2 doses of the new experimental swine flu. That's on the CDC's website. That announcement came out, that was actually by National Institutes of Health on September 21st, they came out with that announcement. Now, there's 2 problems with this. The first problem is in one fell swoop, with no new science, no new testing, no new clinical trials, just they doubled the doses of regular flu shots that they're recommending to be given not only to children but to everyone, you know, because up until now, first of all, flu vaccines have only been recommended for children, mandated for children in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's 1 shot per season. Now, with no new science, all of a sudden they're doubling that, and they're saying kids now need 2 flu shots per season, and in addition to that, kids also need 2 doses of this new experimental swine flu vaccine. So, again, it was... vaccine sales were really sagging, and the whole thing is a desperate attempt to unload all these millions and millions of doses of stockpiled vaccines upon the American people. That is clear as day.
Mm. Wow. That's just so criminal. You know, one thing that you were when you were mentioning about the mercury before and the disinformation about that and making it look like it's not really that bad of a thing, I saw, and I forget when, it was one of the major networks, but it's been a little while now, but they actually came out on there and were saying that small amounts of mercury are actually good for you. And I mean... you're seeing more and more of that stretching of things so far that it's just incredulous.
That is the most criminal, ridiculous, stupid thing that I've ever heard. There has never been an experiment done with mercury since 1930 in which whatever the living cells in the petri dish were, they didn't completely die. You know, it is the 3rd most toxic substance known to man, mercury. And I have a whole chapter on several chapters on mercury on my website, thedoctorwithin.com, as well as a large part of the my vaccine textbook, The Sanctity of Human Blood, and the full-day seminar The Sanctity of Human Blood, deals with not only the toxicity of mercury, but the fact that this mantra, just of what you're saying, usually they don't say anything quite that stupid. That is completely insupportable. But the usual mantra that they say there is no proof that mercury in vaccines causes autism or, you know, neurological damage. When the opposite is true, there is a prodigious amount of documentation, both in mainstream science and in government documents and congressional records, showing how mercury in vaccines and in other sources can cause virtually any neurologic disorder, including autism. So that's when people say something like that, it's just some junior health science writer who's, you know, writing some article in the New York Times. They have no credentials whatsoever, but that's the kind of thing that gets approved by the editors in newspapers today, because, you know, they know that it won't antagonize the real proofreaders who are reading it in the viewpoint of the pharmaceutical companies.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that, you know, and I think, you know, sometimes you'll see maybe a show where they'll have a guest on and they're interviewing them, and they may start exposing the mercury concern and things like that, or whatever it is that they're exposing, and then maybe the next night or the night after that, and someone will be coming on with the kind of a contrary view, softening it back up, because somebody probably got a call and said, we're going to have to change that a little bit. We're going to have to shift that around. Yeah,
exactly.
You can bring this guy on.
It makes them nervous.
Yeah, it makes them nervous. Well, why does the media use the word protection instead of the word immunity?
Because it's the language of media, it's really a very structured and controlled science. I discovered this. I did a whole study of media, the way media evolved, and the philosophy of media, and the linguistics of media. And it's in a chapter on my website called The Doors of Perception, Why Americans Believe Almost Anything. And this phrase that they used, they began to use this summer, with respect to swine flu vaccine, they started using the word protection instead of the word immunization, right? So that's just part of the science of sales, the science of marketing, that they are instructed in these methods of choosing the right word.
Okay. Well, did the CDC really say that it was okay to give a kid two flu shots at the same time, one in each arm?
Yeah. That was CDC and National Institutes of Health. That happened on September 22nd. And the person in the CDC was Ann Suchat. That was her. She must have been off her meds that day when she came out with that. Because, what did she forget? What she learned in biology 101, anatomy 101, that both arms were attached to the same body. I mean, these aren't just medical doctors. I'm telling you, these are medical doctors who are at the top of you know, the entire regulatory machinery of our entire government, making ludicrous, embarrassing statements like that.
Well, they must see us as the most ignorant assets that can be imagined. You know, just dumb consumers who will follow along and do anything they want.
Yeah, it's like, well, they can't reason anymore. But plus, they're not reading, so we can say anything we want, and that's virtually true today.
Yeah. Well, if the preliminary trials for testing the swine flu vaccine only began in August of 2009 and won't be finished until April 2010, how could the swine flu vaccines be disseminated in October 2009? Well, I know you kind of touched on that before, but
What I discovered was I discovered that off the website of one of the vaccine companies. One of the five vaccine companies is called Sanofi Pasteur, and they're out of Switzerland. And they were the ones who admitted online that after 5 weeks of testing that their vaccine for swine flu had been approved by the FDA. You know, and that, it had to be true because the following month, only 3 weeks later, that's when they, in October, was when they started giving out thousands of doses of swine flu vaccine all across the country.
And so they're... Are there any companies testing the new swine flu vaccine?
Yeah, there's five companies, and they all started testing in August, and none of the tests will even be done until April. That's the point. So there's no way that you can. It's just astounding. It's astounding that they would admit that the FDA approved the vaccine after 5 weeks. It's astounding that they admitted that. And the other thing is astounding is, even though that is in that you can see that in mainstream media that people are that unaware or that cavalier about their children's well-being that they would allow their kids to get vaccinated with these vaccines that have never been tested as safe. There's no way you can test. You can invent a vaccine and test it and produce it all in 5 or 6 weeks. That is impossible, but that's exactly what happened this fall.
Hmm. What proof do we have that all of the thousands of cases of swine flu that supposedly have occurred in the last 5 months are actually all the same disease?
None whatsoever. And unless we're going to say that they're all just regular cases of regular flu that have been artificially recategorized for the purposes of marketing this new vaccine.
Yeah. Well, how did we learn that the new swine flu vaccines contain mercury?
The short version of this is, before, it all changed in 2005. Before 2005, there were four vaccines on the mandated schedule that every single dose of them contained mercury. That includes the hepatitis B shot, the Haemophilus influenza shot, the polio shot, and the flu shot. Now, at the beginning of 2005, the manufacturers began to feel all this bad press about mercury, and even though the FDA never made mercury illegal in vaccines. In 2005, the vaccine manufacturers began to voluntarily begin to leave mercury out. But since it was never made illegal, we'll have all these millions of doses of stockpiled vaccines that can still continue to be given out and are continuing to be given out in every clinic across the United States for the next, 20 years or more. So, but what I want to tell you is the one vaccine that has continued to be manufactured with thimerosal is the flu shot, okay? So that's how we know why that's how we expected that the swine flu vaccine, why would it be any different from the regular flu shot in which was produced, manufactured with mercury. But the astounding thing, as we said, was when they came out and made the announcement that this particular H1N1 vaccine was going to contain unlimited levels of mercury, and the astounding thing was is even that announcement in mainstream media did not prevent thousands and thousands of people from giving this vaccine to their child anyway. It's like, what are, we're looking at Darwin in action here.
Yeah, geez. Well, I think you said the clinical trials of the new swine flu vaccine started in August of last year, right?
Yeah.
When were they licensed?
They were licensed in September. They were licensed in September, in the middle of September. Yeah.
After the fact?
No.
Oh.
You don't understand.
Okay,
August is when they were the vaccines were they just started testing them. They just started inventing the vaccine, supposedly, in August.
Okay.
The clinical trials began for the new vaccine. The clinical trials began in August. And they were supposed to run for 6 months until April. And even that, as I said, is only half the time that vaccines usually take to get tested. Usually it takes a year. So that was already ridiculous, cutting it down to 6 months. But then when I discovered that they were licensed after 5 weeks in the middle of September, you know, that it was just, we have no regard for our children's well-being. You know, it's just so cavalier what we're doing to our children.
Hmm. Well, what happened in Europe in January with investigation of the World Health Organization for creating a false pandemic?
Yeah, that's what I was telling you about this group called PACE, or the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, and Wolfgang Wodarg. And so you can find out that information by Googling the phrase false pandemic. I'm going to Europe to do this, to do my seminar in May, actually, and I'm going to be interviewing that doctor in Berlin.
Hmm. That should be very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think will happen now with the way things have gone, a lot of people not going along with, some going and some not, and more awareness that being disseminated all over the place? Where do you think things are headed now? What are we going to see happen?
Well, my prediction is the swine flu is going to fade out completely by the summer, and they're just going to give up trying to market it because people just don't believe them. It doesn't make any sense. But then within a year or so, definitely, when they see, you know, billions of dollars of windfall profits as their motivator, and they see how successful, you know, they don't care if these threats fade away into nothing. All they care about is that the threat was made viable long enough for the governments to spend billions of dollars on the development and creation of these worthless vaccines. That's all they care about, right? So, like I said, it has happened 5 times in the last 8 or 9 years, and it's definitely, now the pattern is so well ingrained in our culture, they can trot that out any time and make it happen any time they want, and that will be happening in the future.
Mm.
I call it the boutique epidemic.
Yes. Well, how about, is there a book that talks about the problems with current vaccine policy, or any audios like CDs, DVDs, that sort of thing?
Yeah. It's the best book I know of that's annotated and it's referenced so well is actually my 13th edition of the book, The Sanctity of Human Blood, Vaccination is Not Immunization. And people can get that on the website, which is thedoctorwithin.com. In addition to that, if people want to watch the DVD set of the full-day vaccine seminar, that's also available at the same website, thedoctorwithin.com.
Mm, okay.
But my opinion is for the young parents, people who have, young children or they're about to start a family, my opinion is you can't make a responsible, informed decision on these issues just by notions that you talk to somebody here or there, you read an article in Reader's Digest, or you listen to something that Oprah says or whatever. You know, the information, the referenced information is available, and there's a serious amount of controversy about this particular issue, and it seems to me that the parents have a responsibility to their unborn or newborn child to investigate for themselves to see if there's anything really behind all this opposition, all this doubt that we have about what everybody knows about vaccines. Namely, everybody thinks they're safe and effective. Are there any problems with that? In some legitimately referenced sources that really talk about those issues.
I was wondering about this adult schedule that you've talked about. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
About what, Earl?
The the adult schedule?
Oh, yeah. That happened, I believe that was in February of 2008. All of a sudden, this on the CDC website, one day there appeared this adult schedule of immunizations. It looked like it had been there for 30 years, but it just started in February of 2008. They just decided, well, you know, up till now we've been saying that, you know, it's the childhood immunization schedule, which ends when the child is 18, which is bad enough. Now it's 68 vaccines mandated by the time the American child is 18 years old. 68 vaccines. You know, when you and me were kids, it was like four, okay? Now it's up to 68. But for these people, even that wasn't enough. Now, as of February 08, these guys in Washington, they decided one day, well, you know, why are we ignoring the biggest demographic of all, the adult population? Let's market that too. And so one day, this recommended adult immunization schedule of an additional 74 or something vaccines, 73 vaccines, whatever it is, appeared on the CDC website. And these are for people, you know, 19 to 60, age 19 to 60 are recommended to get an additional 70-some vaccines during that period. This is a brand-new marketing technique.
Hmm. Well, how do we compare with other countries? They don't have all these vaccines, right?
No. Like, I lecture in Europe usually every year, and it's around 33 vaccines, you know, recommended by the time a kid is 18, you know, which is bad enough, but at least it's less than half of what we have here in America. And the other thing is, it's not this revolving door where it's changing every few months. This is the only country in the world that has that going on, you know, where we pursue this really aggressive aggressive kind of using our own children as the kind of as the experimental group for testing all the new vaccines that are, you know, politically mandated that particular month or season. We're the only people who do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering if the health of our children reflects all of this intervention versus other countries, since we're the most vaccinated country on earth.
Yeah. No, of course not. I mean, the health of our children is appalling. And this is, you know, our children are fatter, sicker, and dumber than they have ever been in our history. And each one of those areas is getting worse as time goes by. And we're running out of time here, but that's really the point of my second full-day seminar, the Holistic Nutrition and Detoxification Program. I have a whole program for autistic kids, a whole program for detoxing the residual effects of processed and genetically modified foods from people. That's a whole different area that's covered at my website, thedoctorwithin.com.
Okay. Well, I know that your time is almost done for the webinar. Are we pretty much there for you? Or
Yes, I have another appointment now.
Okay. That's fine. I really appreciate it, Doctor. It's been a pleasure, and we might, in fact, want to see about getting you back on sometime and covering some more area. And I invite everyone to come to the Freedom Law School 2010 Take Back America Health and Freedom Conference and actually meet Dr. O'Shea and hear more. And it's a real experience for those who have not been to it. Those that have been to this conference know it's very unique.
Yes, I want to second that. Payman's event that's coming up there in March 13th, 14th, whenever that is. I'm going to speak on the 14th, which is Sunday. But he's going to have some great presenters. Sally Fallon's going to be there. Who wrote Nancy Appleton is another fantastic presenter. So it's going to be about freedom of choice in health, you know, and it's going to be really a worthwhile event to come to there in Ontario, California.
Yes, and for more information on that, go to freedomlawconference.com. And Doctor, if you wouldn't, in just a second after I say a couple of more things, if you there's a final thoughts that you'd like to share with us, and then maybe give out your contact information once more. I want to invite everyone to join us again tomorrow at the same time. We'll have Ramiel Nagel, who's going to share with some very interesting information from his research and his experience. And we've got for the rest of the week, in fact, he's going to talk about, is there really a cure for tooth decay? And then we're going to have on Thursday Dr. Orly Tates Esquire. She's a doctor and an attorney, and she's going to talk about some constitutional issues that are going to be very interesting. And we'll conclude this week on Friday with Joe Bannister. He's a former criminal investigator for the IRS. He's now exposing the criminal actions of the IRS. So with that, I invite everyone to join us tomorrow. And, Doctor, if you would, if you want to give out your contact information and any final thought, this will be a great time for that.
Okay. My final thought would be this. No child is born with an intact immune system. When a child is born, that child's immune system is literally struggling its way into existence. It hasn't even formed rudimentarily until they're 2 years old. So any kind of toxic assault that happens to the child's blood during that period is going to be detrimental to the formation of a normal vital immune system. So vaccines are one of the single most toxic assaults that can occur to the normal development of the immune system at during that period of time. So this is really the point of my work, both my DVDs and my textbook and my website. So my opinion is that parents have a responsibility to make an informed decision about whether or not they're going to subject their child to this type of, you know, this type of experimental assault on the immune system. So that's really the point of my work. My website, once again, is www.thedoctorwithin.com. And I want to thank you for inviting me to this webinar, Earl. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to meeting you at the conference and hearing more of what you have to say. It's been fascinating, and I know that this has been recorded, so it's going to be on replay. That'll be posted shortly. You can find it at republicmagazine.com/webinar. And, you know, certainly share it. Get it out to other people. You know, you're free to send them out and disseminate them widely today, not only today's, but the other ones that you find there. There's quite a treasure trove, so enjoy that. And with that, thank you so much, Dr. O'Shea. And this is Earl Bell, and we will see you all tomorrow. And this officially ends our webinar. Have a great rest of the day.
The moderator has left the conference.